And our preaching text, as we make our way through Acts, this is Acts 21:37 to 22:29. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian, then, who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" And Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, "Brothers and fathers, hear the defense that I now make before you." And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew language, they became even more quiet. And he said, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus in Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the strict manner of the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, as all of you are this day. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering to prison both men and women. The high priest and the whole council of elders can bear me witness. From them I received letters to the brothers, and I journeyed toward Damascus to take those also who were there and bring them in bonds to Jerusalem to be punished. As I was on my way and drew near to Damascus, about noon, a great light from heaven suddenly shone around me. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And I answered, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. Now those who were with me saw the light, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, "What shall I do, Lord?" And the Lord said to me, 'Rise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all that is appointed for you to do.' And since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. And one Ananias, a devout man according to the law, well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me and standing by me said to me, 'Brother Saul, receive your sight.' And at that very hour I received my sight and saw him. And he said, 'The God of our fathers appointed you to know his will, to see the righteous one, to hear a voice from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to everyone of what you have seen and heard. And now, why do you wait? Why isn't be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name?' When I had returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple, I fell into a trance and saw him saying to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me.' And I said, 'Lord, they themselves know that in one synagogue after another, I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of Stephen, your witness, was being shed, I myself was standing by, approving and watching over the garments of those who killed him.' And he said to me, 'Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles.' Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live.' And as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust in the air, the tribune ordered him to be brought into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by flogging to find out why they were shouting against him like this. But when they had stretched him out for the whips, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, 'Is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned?' When the centurion heard this, he went to the tribune and said to him, 'What are you about to do? For this man is a Roman citizen.' So the tribune came and said to him, 'Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?' And he said, 'Yes.' The tribune answered, 'I bought this citizenship for a large sum.' Paul said, 'I am a citizen by birth.' So those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately, and the tribune also was afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him." Paul is just beginning to suffer a lot for being misunderstood, is he not? It's bad enough to be suffering for the truth. A lot of distortion surrounding him. In my trip to San Antonio, I read a 300-page history of the Knights Templar. Talk about being misunderstood. And they are one of the most enigmatic, controversial religious orders in all of church history, are they not? They're the favorite target of every conspiracy theory, ranging from being the founders of the Illuminati to always finding their way into the books of Dan Brown. Don't you get tired of Dan Brown's books? Most notably, the Da Vinci Code. The Knights Templar play a big part in his book. Well, is that reputation deserved or misguided? I wanted to find out for myself. I'm into my second book on the Knights Templar, as a matter of fact. The Knights Templar were a religious order of the Roman Catholic Church founded in 1118 A.D., A.D. 1118, in the wake of the First Crusade. They were an answer to, what is the best solution to Christians being robbed, beaten, raped, and killed as they made pilgrimage to Jerusalem and the Holy Land? Should you meekly let yourself be robbed, beaten, raped, and killed, like some would interpret the Sermon on the Mount? Or don't go on one of the most important journeys of a lifetime? Pilgrimage to the Holy Land was indeed considered a means of penance in the Middle Ages. Or you could exercise your Second Amendment rights and defend yourself. I know that's a little ahead of the Constitution, but you get the sense. The Knights Templar founded on this last option. Because among the pilgrims of the First Crusade were many knights of France and England and Germany, and they found themselves fighting the bandits and the Muslims in defending the pilgrims and the soldiers of the crusade. Realizing the profound necessity for a military component in a religious endeavor, they are not mutually exclusive. Nine particularly spiritual knights swore a covenant with one another to remain in the Holy Land, not to go back home to their estates, but rather remain in the Holy Land and dedicate their lives to protecting and defending the Christians of Jerusalem and the Holy Land. And they would do so by taking the same vows that monks did, those of poverty, chastity, and obedience. The only difference would be instead of being sequestered in a monastery, praying, copying scriptures, and meditating, this sounds like a lot more fun, the Knights Templar, named after their quarters on the site of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem, where the mosque is now, right? That they would continue to practice their battle skills against those bandits and Muslims and Byzantine renegades. Only they would do it in the name of Christ and His church. Now you'll find the Knights Templar, especially in their early years, were brave and spiritual and self-sacrificing, true to their mission. When they heard a 911 call that any group of Christians was being attacked, they would drop what they were doing, mount up, and ride out to meet the foe, no matter what the odds. No matter what the odds. And sometimes they were as much as 100 to 1. And they quickly earned a reputation from the surrounding Muslim imams and caliphs for being fierce, tenacious fighters who were also deeply spiritual. What happened then? Why have they gotten the reputation they have? Well, in their latter days, long after the Crusades had subsided, spent themselves, they were accused of horrible things. Financial corruption, devil worship, sodomy, murder in order to steal Christian relics. They were at one time supposedly in possession of the Shroud of Turin, the Holy Grail, the True Cross, even though there was enough wood throughout Europe to make a factory of crosses. But the thing to keep in mind, though, and the thing I have discovered, be careful of the people making the accusations. What do they have to gain? King Philip of France is the culprit who stood to gain the most by the dissolution of the Knights Templar. And this is a wicked man, King Philip. Always chronically short of money for his wars of expansion, Philip wanted the treasures, the banking cash, the gold of the Knights Templar. Therefore, he brought specious charges against them. He arrested over 5,000 Templars in one night, tortured confessions, quote unquote, from them. Hundreds were subsequently burned at the stake, and his notorious henchman, Prince de Nogaret, not many people know that name, Prince de Nogaret, who is King Philip's henchman, and he's as evil as the head of the Inquisition, Torquemada, few more people have heard of Torquemada, perhaps, head of the Inquisition with the thumb screws and the rack and all the rest. Well, this guy used the same kind of techniques to obtain confessions from the Templars. In short, there's nothing that cannot be done to a man burned at the stake, like Jacques de Molay, the last Grand Master of the Knights Templar. If lies can be made plausible, we see this in the Apostle Paul's life. Clever liars can do precisely this, can't they? One of my favorite sayings is, figures never lie, but liars can figure, can they not? A man's effectiveness can be diminished if a shadow of doubt can be cast across his character and reputation, and evil men attempt to do these very things. This is precisely what's being done to the Apostle Paul by his enemies here in our text. We'll be dogged, we'll be nagged by these things all of his ministry, will he not? We see this in the opening chapter of Galatians that we read today. And in the face of this, then, Paul will, on three different occasions, give his testimony which Luke records in great detail. Why does he do this? Thus, the title for today, Testimony 2. Testimony 2. This is the second testimony, fulsome testimony, considering the manuscripts of the ancient world that Luke has given to us. Let's look to it today. First of all, point number one, encompassing chapter 21, verse 37 to 22, 2. A captive of mistaken identity, Paul appeals to his Jewish citizenship to speak to his Hebrew brothers. Paul appeals to his Jewish citizenship to speak to his Jewish brothers. He covers three kinds of citizenship here today. Our text finds us today with Paul under arrest by the Roman tribune of the legion, garrisoned in the fortress Antonia, right near the temple precincts. Paul's crime? Ostensibly starting a riot. Already a misrepresentation, isn't it? Ostensibly starting a riot in the temple, intending to excite an insurrection against Roman occupation. This is the tribune's view of these things as he comes in, isn't it? A distortion already. The tribune indicates this in his surprise that Paul can ask a question in Greek. When he says, may I say something to you in Greek? I thought of citing this in Greek, but it would mean nothing to most of us. But he asks him this question in Greek. And almost 3 years previous to this, an Egyptian adventurer had appeared in Jerusalem, claiming to be a prophet. Now, the Jewish historian Josephus, you hear his name mentioned by me from time to time, but I keep telling you, you don't know. Middle East, Israeli, Palestinian background until you've read Josephus. So sometimes you'll see in the book clubs one of those thick volumes of Josephus's works. Pick it up and peruse it, read it from time to time. It'll give you some good background. He describes this Egyptian adventurer in both his Jewish wars and the history of the Jews as well. Well, this guy led a band of followers to the Mount of Olives. Said that at his word, the end of the world would come and the Romans would be destroyed. Sounds like right out of the pages of dispensational history today, isn't it? And then when the Roman procurator Felix, and we'll meet him, file that name away, we'll meet him pretty soon as well. When the Roman procurator Felix sent out troops to arrest and destroy them, this Egyptian disappeared. So the tribune assumes that Paul is this guy, who would not be expected to speak educated Greek either. So that's a surprise when he finds out that Paul asks him a question in fluent Greek. Do you see how presumptions about a man's character and behavior can skew your treatment of him? Maybe to a more or less degree, we have all experienced things like this. People who have had presumptions and assumptions about us that were misguided or untrue. Also ask yourself, too, who is seeking the facts here? Remember, this brief will appear before Claudius the emperor and be read before Claudius the emperor in Paul's defense. Who is the one who is seeking the facts here? Of course, it's the Roman magistrate, as it is in almost every encounter that we have in Acts. Ostensibly the enemy of justice, But he's really not, is he? We find that with almost all the Roman magistrates. It is rather the Jewish mob in Jerusalem, as it was the Gentile mob in Ephesus, that's irrational, swept along by mob passions. In both Ephesus and Jerusalem, one must ask, under whose care would I rather be? That of the respective mobs or the Romans? The answer comes back consistently from our narrative, does it not? It is the Romans who, the ones who are sincere and practice law as they are inculcated to practice it, who derive justice. So, at the time of our narrative, Tarsus was a prestigious city in the Middle East. It was a prosperous commercial city and intellectual center, and larded stocked with many Roman citizens. So now, this tribune, having his entire understanding of Paul revamped, he consents to let Paul speak to this still agitated mob outside. We see this in our news reports all the time, sometimes in America too, how mobs are agitated when you're anonymous, you share passions with those around you, how easy it is to get agitated and stay agitated and be anonymous and let your passions rule, right? But I also want you to note Luke's narrative skill here too. We'll be very crucial in understanding our text today. Note the drama that Luke creates in Paul's address here too. He silences the mob, Paul does, in two stages, one with a wave of his hand. Here's this upstart. He wants to address us now, right? And then a still hush when they hear him speaking in Hebrew. So Luke here is underlining Paul's Jewish heritage, checking off his origins in Tarsus, his facility in the language of the Torah, that is Hebrew. Paul is appealing to his Jewish citizenship, a citizenship of race, not naturalization, right? In order to gain an audience with the people. What is the consequence? Point two, verses 22, verse 3 to verse 21, testimony 2. A captive of his spiritual identity now, right? Paul appeals to his heavenly citizenship to preach to the Gentiles. Paul now begins to relate his testimony in a fulsome way for the second time, doesn't he? Is this not deja vu all over again? Haven't we heard this experience on the road to Damascus already in chapter 9? Well, all I can say is brace yourself, dear listener, for you will hear it again in the same excruciating detail in chapter 26. Why does Luke, our narrator, do this? I've been bragging on his writing skill, his narrative skills, all through this book. And here he goes again. Haven't we heard this? Do we need to hear this again a second time? Does he have a reason? If indeed the skill of a narrator is in part, not only in what he includes, but also in what he excludes, is Luke just a clumsy oaf here? Has he forgotten these skills to narrate this incident not one, not two, but three times? In its fullness, the same experience. Is he coming down with Alzheimer's? Did he forget, or is he just a lousy writer? And of course, we say, au contraire, we say no to all of the above, because Luke pulls his words out of his head, not his hat. Why then does he do this? Well, we know from Acts and Paul's letters, we know three things. Note these three things about Paul and his ministry from both Acts and his letters. We sampled Galatians now, where he states these things very strongly. Number one, Paul's apostleship was contested, wasn't it? Paul's apostleship was contested. And you know his enemies would be standing at his elbow, bringing this up to Claudius the emperor when he appeared before him. The Judaizers would follow in the wake of Paul's missionary campaigns. We saw this all through Acts, and they would pour poison in the ears of the new converts, questioning in part his credentials as an apostle. We know this from Galatians 1 and 2, where he vigorously defends his place as a called apostle, though lately born by his own admission. But nevertheless, if the qualifications for being an apostle included personally walking with a risen Christ, and he did this for 14 years in Cilicia and Syria, and being called to ministry personally by Christ, then Paul qualifies. And this narrative underlines it. Okay? Second thing that we see from Paul's letters and from Acts is that Paul's Jewish credentials were questioned. How often does Paul defend his Jewish credentials? All through his letters, right? And here, then again? But you can understand how the average Jew, Christian or unconverted, to them, the thought of a Jewish apostle to Gentiles was an oxymoron. Talk about cognitive dissonance in the mind of a Jew. Messiah is for Israel. Messiah is for Jews. If a Gentile wanted in, well, fine, adopt our ways, become one of us, but to actively go out and seek Gentiles on their terms, oh, these uncircumcised Philistines scarfing bacon. No, away with such an apostle, right? How could such a man even be a Jew, really? You know, this is the attitude of Jonah, right, that we saw in our Old Testament reading today. Poor, navel-gazing Jonah. Go out and save Nineveh. No! Pout. I'll pout instead. Well, these Jews, the same attitude as Jonah. Thirdly, we also see through his letters and in the book of Acts, the consistency of Paul's message was questioned too. That's why he was so, repeated twice. Anybody preaches another gospel, if even I come to you and preach another gospel than the one I've already preached, let him be accursed. Then he has to say, am I now preaching a man's gospel? Am I now backtracking? Am I now saying something else than I've already said? No. Because his consistency of a message was under question too. His enemies said he preached one thing in Jerusalem and another thing in Ephesus. One thing to Gentiles, one thing to Jews. Because as we have observed in our New Testament reading this morning, Paul goes to great pains to assert the consistency of his message. As I said before, so now I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. Am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Am I now trying to please man? So by repeating his testimony on three different occasions, Paul underlines this consistency across the board. Okay? So these are the reasons why Luke includes three fulsome accounts. Not just because it happened, not just because he's got nothing better to do or nothing better to put in. He has a purpose and a reason for including these three fulsome accounts. And additionally, Luke intends for us to observe that the consistency of Paul's testimony stretches across three distinct audiences, too. Note this. Three distinct audiences. We, the disciples in chapter 9, his Jewish brethren in chapter 22, and then the last and final audience for his trial before Emperor Tiberius, you have the civil magistrates in chapter 26. The implicit message to Tiberius is, sir, all of your Roman predecessors were consistent in exonerating Paul, shouldn't you? That will be the implicit message in all of these accounts to Tiberius. Well, with this in mind, we observe again the facts of Paul's conversion. And we've seen this in some detail already, so I'll just go over them briefly, but they're consistent one with another. Told perhaps in different words, different things amplified, different things diminished, but the facts are consistent. I was a good old boy, right? I was a good old boy, a Jew's Jew, who zealously persecuted the one I now serve, and all of his followers, some of them even to the death. As I was on my way to Damascus with letters from the Sanhedrin, right? I had a Damascus Road experience. Wait a minute, that expression hadn't been coined yet, had it? Well, I was on my way to arrest Christers I was arrested by the Christ himself. My physical sight was blinded. My spiritual sight was given eyes, and my ears unstopped by his voice, though insensible to my companions. A Gentile. How humiliating for this proud Jew. A Gentile, Ananias, one whom I probably would have arrested and killed if I was unimpeded, he ministered to me. Later, back at the ranch, that is in Jerusalem and at the temple, note these details not present in the other narrative too. He says, I received a commission from God to bear the gospel to the Gentiles. I received a commission from God to live out this oxymoronic life, a Jew, Jew of Jews, bearing the gospel to the Gentiles. We have here, in these three examples of Paul's testimony, just a beautiful sample of a Christian testimony too, isn't it? Let me recommend to you a couple things. I can't let this pass. I have a course, if you will, several lessons on how to develop and cultivate and write your own testimony. And these are Exhibit A. First of all, labor over your own testimony too, all right? These are good examples. Labor over your own testimony, number one. A Christian should not only have some familiarity, if not a mastery, please have a mastery of the objective facts of the gospel, things like the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, justification by faith alone, through Christ alone, but also you should give some forethought concerning your own personal journey to Christ, your own personal testimony. As I look out on your faces, it just clicks with me, you know, that so many poignant and gracious testimonies of God's calling you to himself. No matter what your experience of him may be, it is your experience and cannot be gainsaid. While one's personal experience is never enough to establish the objective truth of a thing, there's no objective truth that matters unless it enters into the personal subjective life of the believer. Isn't that true? All of the objective antidote on the shelf is useless unless it's swallowed and becomes part of our physiology, right? Of the one poison, we've been poisoned by sin. So it is with the gospel. Objective truth of the gospel, real true salvation in Christ, is useless to a lost man unless it is believed and appropriated by the man of faith in his or her real life circumstances. And all of our real life circumstances are unique. Your faith and its appropriation is that personal salvation and redemption. And is a strong undergirding to the objective facts, a confirmation of the objective facts of the gospel. Secondly, craft a time-sensitive testimony. As in your gospel presentation, practice, and I commend this to you, practice a 2-minute drill, a 20-minute drill, and a 1-hour drill, okay? Your time with a seatmate on an airline is much briefer than that with a neighbor or family member who you will see over dinner, coffee on multiple occasions. I'd still be on the tarmac at IF Airport if I took the same approach to my recent seatmate from San Antonio that I do with the Hansons that have the ranch next door to me. I've got more time with the Hansons than I did with the seatmate. Thirdly, craft a culture-sensitive testimony. Paul does this here. Do a comparison. Put these three next to each other and see the different things he amplifies, the different things he leaves out. For instance, the enemy he was, the things that are consistent across the testimonies, the enemy he was, the gracious arrest by the risen Christ, his subsequent helplessness, his call and commission as an apostle to the Gentiles, all these things are consistent across all three of them. But there's also those elements which Paul decides to add depending on his audience he addresses or leave out. For example, here, just notice here, he includes his tutelage under Gamaliel, which would have been meaningless to Felix and the Gentile kings. His origins in Tarsus, in particular, the letters from the Sanhedrin. That would have rung a bell with them, which are not included in the other accounts. He has a purpose in persuading these Jews, doesn't he? We will observe different elements when he speaks to Gentile kings in chapter 26. But once more, part of the skill in speaking and writing as a Christian is giving some forethought to these things. How you edit that which you include, that which you exclude, it's crucial to your testimony. When the Bass family lived in Evanston, Illinois, our family was in a stage that a lot of you are now. We had young kids in the house. Many fine memories. At one point, I was sharing the gospel. I was a student at the time. I was sharing the gospel with two different people. One, a university professor at Northwestern University, which is in Evanston, Illinois. And I was also sharing the gospel with a Muslim from Pakistan who worked as a security guard. Now, let me describe how I presented the gospel to these two different men and let you decide which is which, okay? With one, I took what meager, distorted facts he had gathered from Islam in his Quran about Jesus, used that as a starting place, corrected those distortions, enlarged them from the Bible on who this Jesus really was, that he had only heard about vaguely and distortedly from his Quran. With the other, I read Francis Schaeffer. I discussed worldviews, history, existential philosophy, which he had embraced as a college student himself, as I had. Which was which? which was the university professor and which was the security guard? What if I had transposed those approaches? Oh, I'm sure I would have driven my Pakistani friend to terrorism if I discussed existentialism with him, right? And my university friend to boredom, or maybe terrorism too, of another kind, if I had spoken of the simple elemental facts of Jesus. He already knew these. He'd grown up a Methodist. The upshot is to take the time to craft your testimony and a presentation of the gospel to your audience. Sterling examples here in the book of Acts. And Paul is doing well. So far, so good, right? Until he gets to this magic word, Gentile. Oh, boy. That brings us to point three, testimony, part two. A captive of his earthly enemies, Paul appeals to his Roman citizenship to plead before Caesar. The die will be cast, as Caesar would say. Hereafter, verses 22 to 29 in chapter 22. Well, Luke narrates the inflammatory moment, right? He says, up to this word, Gentile, wave a red flag in front of a bull, want to get charged, throw a match into a can of gasoline, Gentile, to a Jew, right? Away with such a fellow. He doesn't deserve to live. He should be allowed to die. It would also bear fruit to do a comparison study of the riot in Ephesus compared with the riot in Jerusalem and observe the similarities and differences too. There. Luke clearly intends to account for why this man seems to stir up trouble wherever he goes. That would get old after a while, don't you think? If every time I preached a sermon a riot started, I'd have... I've almost incited a few here. Have you rushed the pulpit, right? What if that happened every time I preached a sermon? You'd say, you'd be a little more hesitant to get into the pulpit, wouldn't you? This happens to Paul time and time again, doesn't it? But maybe that's the problem with modern preaching. Maybe that's a problem with my preaching too, if indeed it should stir up a little more from time to time, don't you think? Well, this man, the Apostle Paul, and this reputation would precede him, wouldn't it, to Tiberius? This guy's a troublemaker. Wherever he goes, there's riots, there's turmoil, turning the world upside down. We've seen that phrase already. And as well, this label will tend to stick to Christianity throughout its spread in the Roman Empire. This is chronic with the faith as it spreads throughout the... And you find as you read the church fathers, this was indeed a problem that they encountered time after time after time. Lies, distortions, misrepresentations. Did you know those Christians are cannibals? This was one of the accusations against Christianity in its early days. They eat the body and blood of their Savior. They're cannibals. But note, it is always the message of the gospel, not the motives and movements of the bearer, that incite disorder. That is true throughout the book of Acts. It is always the message of the gospel, not the motives and movements and character of the bearer that incites disorder. And Luke is very clear about making this explicit and very, very clear to the reader, right? If there's any truth to this account at all, it is always the message of the gospel, not the motives, movements, and character of the bearer that incites disorder. It is the revolutionary nature of the gospel that threatens to turn upside down the respective worlds of the pagan, right? The silversmiths and their trade. It's not the message. It's not Paul that causes such concern amongst the silversmiths. We'll lose our trade, he says. The greatness of Ephesus will diminish. It'll upturn the world of the Jews as well. There goes our customs and our pride of place if Gentiles are allowed to live the way they did before. The gospel is a threat. The gospel is a threat to these, not the character, the movements, motives of its bearers. It is never the insidious, wicked character of the bearer of the gospel that creates problems. Luke is very, very insistent that the character and the motives are pure amongst its bearers. We learn this by narrative, don't we? We learn this once again by narrative. In fact, we learn that those who bring the gospel actually do good in the empire. Healing diseases, making good men out of bad, sharing what earthly goods they have with all. And Paul is one such man. Now, take the place of the tribune. Now, remember, he speaks Greek, speaks Latin, but he doesn't speak Hebrew. So he's watching all of this transpire with this hushed tone. Paul has their rapt attention, right? Oh, things seem to be going well. Having learned of his mistaken identification of Paul, he bears with him. Until, voila! Can you see why they were exasperated to try and rule these Jews? They're like the Germans. They're either at your feet or at your throat, as Churchill said about the Germans. So it is with these Jews. The very thing the tribune was there to prevent, that is a riot, right? He could have been disciplined for not controlling or quelling the riot. So his first job is to stop the riot. And it flares up right in front of him again. Personally, I don't blame him for saying by his actions, all right, that's it. I'm going to get the bottom of this one way or another, right? And he does it the way tyrants have always done it. He sits down with them over a cup of coffee, takes notes on their conversation, right? No. He has them stretched out on the rack, back in the barracks, so that he might be beaten with whips until he finds out why they're so upset with him. That's my preferred method, too. I have to resist that. I've been reading a lot of history lately, and it becomes both tedious and nauseating, though. I say that in levity, because I have been reading a lot of history, and it becomes tedious and nauseating to see this method of interrogation used throughout history. And we aren't that enlightened, let me tell you. We're not that enlightened here, either. I read a biography of Stalin. Just finished that recently. He wanted to know in his purges whether any given suspect was a Trotskyite or a counter-revolutionary, so he sent them to the torture chambers in the Kremlin. And wonder of wonders, 99% of them confessed. The other 1% died before they got confessions from them. I'm reading now a biography of Mao. He wanted to know in his great leap forward whether the middle class were counter-revolutionary, so he tortured them until again, wonder of wonders, they all confessed. And they were sent to re-education camps where they died. In reading the history of the Crusades and the Knights Templar, you discover that both the Crusaders and the Muslims practiced torture as a means of interrogation. Wonder of wonders, they usually got the confessions they were seeking. Thus, the Templars were burned at the stake. Well, here, Paul is about to undergo the same until he mentions that he's a Roman citizen. And that quickly brings the torture to a halt as the tribune discovers that Paul was born into a citizenship while he had to purchase his at a great price. So here, amidst the turmoil generated by the gospel, not the gospelers, the gospel incites the turmoil when it is preached. Always make sure that that's the case for us too. Make sure it's not us, but the gospel that causes the turmoil. Do not be ashamed of the gospel. That phrase I'm sure you've heard of before. Do not be ashamed of the gospel, nor ashamed to the gospel. And it's here, then, where the die is cast, where he crosses his Rubicon, as Caesar would say, he begins his journey to Rome. By availing himself of the privilege of his Roman citizenship, Paul would have much rather, I'm sure, been a pilgrim or a traveler, but he will go there as a captive, will he not? He'll go there as a prisoner. Is he a criminal, therefore? Is he a troublemaker? Is it a thing proceeding from his wicked character that brings him before the tribunal of Caesar? Now, how often the rumor determines how we prejudge people. Like a sweet morsel in the ear is a rumor, as the Solomon says in the Proverbs. How often the distorted story from an enemy shapes our perspective on a man. It can even shape the view of the gospel that we bear. The evil one is fond of doing this, is he not? Well, we will see this unfold. We will see Luke patiently demonstrate, not only for Tiberius, but for a watching and listening world, that it is indeed the gospel that will overturn, that will turn over the world, if you will, and not the grim character of its bearers that will do these things. As well, know your discipleship, brothers and sisters. Know your discipleship. It may take you places you know not. Anybody willing to bet on where they will end? Will you die peaceably in your bed, or will you die at the hands of a torturer, of one who persecutes and kills? We can't say, can we? Especially in our own day and age. God will take you in two places and in ways you cannot now foresee. But know that as God has borne up Paul all along, he will bear you up all along as well. In order to aid you in this, let us now come to that place where we find grace to bear us along. We find that grace in the body and blood of the Savior and the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.